everybody, and welcome back to Your Critically Acclaimed, the podcast where it's your critically acclaimed.
It's yours, and you are also critically acclaimed.
That's true.
There's double meaning in that.
My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibel. I, too, am a critic, and I don't have a cool nickname.
And yet, here you are. Yeah, this is a podcast that is dedicated to our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. You request at a certain tier. You can have your own podcast made for you to spec. You give us a pitch for what you want as a podcast, and, you know, we might need to have a small conversation about it, but generally speaking, it's a rubber stamp. It sounds good, let's do it. And we're way behind on them, but this is one we've been wanting to get to for a while. Mm. This comes from our patron, David Cooper. And David Cooper wanted us to talk about a film that won the Nigerian Academy Award for Best Picture. And I think that's really cool. Mm-hmm. We haven't really talked a lot about what is called Nollywood, which is...
That is Nigerian Hollywood.
Yeah, which is actually kind of a big deal. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these movies don't get screened here in America, or they don't get a lot of fanfare, and that stinks. And, yeah. You know, unfortunately, America is very big about trying to send all of our movies out everywhere in the world, but when it comes to bringing other movies into America... All of a sudden, there just doesn't seem to be a lot of space. But fortunately, streaming services, which are, you know, just constantly just pulling at all from wherever they can find to get new movies and TV shows to show.
They just want to fill their coffers. Yeah. They just need movies.
Yeah, it's a shame they don't go further back into history for it, but there is a lot of international cinema and a lot of international television that's available, even at larger services like Netflix, and that's true here. Where they have been showing the 2018.
Yeah.
It won the 2019 Nigerian Academy Award for Best Picture, but it's a 2018 crime drama called King of Boys.
I have a question for you. I want you to think carefully before you answer. Lọ́sẹ̀ kan sísìn, ọmọkùnrin yẹn àti ọmọ yín kẹ rí wọn ní ìgbéyàwó tàbí kẹ gbọ́ ìròyìn wípé ọmọkùnrin náà fòṣọlẹ̀ òkú. Èwo lẹ fẹ́?
Mama, we need to see you. Adé tó dé yẹn, kò dé fún ẹ ní orí.
Makanaki, ṣé nǹkan ṣe ẹ ni?
You have drawn the battle line.
Stand him up.
You have stepped on the tail of the tiger.
King of Boys.
King of Boys. It's a 3-hour crime epic, very much in the vein of The Godfather. In fact, very much in the vein of The Godfather, because a lot of the story beats are kind of similar, especially at the beginning.
Well, I feel like it starts off very much at The Godfather. It opens at a big party, for example, where there's this crime lord played by, and I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Solo Sabawale. She plays a crime boss named Eniola Salami. And she has worked her way up from nothing. And as the film progresses, we start getting a bit more Godfather Part 2 kind of flashbacks as we see her, like,
rise through the ranks.
Fight her way through it in a way that, you know, as a woman, she wasn't really allowed into that world, but she used the resources she had at her disposal to manipulate a crime boss into leaving her everything. Mm. So we see her in just full glow. She's like buying off senators, and she's giving, like, you know, free favors to the people in exchange for, you know, personal favors, not unlike The Godfather.
Getting love from the community is a big part of it. She actually helps people out. So they will love her. Mm-hmm. She calls herself King, not Queen. Mm-hmm. She is the King of Boys. And it's King of Boys because all of the other, like, crime bosses are hot-headed and really tempestuous. Mm-hmm. They're, like, killing each other, and they're really eager to get violence started. And she kind of understands that's just play. That's not the way to... You can kill somebody and rise to the top, but you won't stay there.
There's a line I really like in the movie Way of the Gun. where James Caan plays a hitman. And this is not like young James Caan. This is like James Caan from like the last 20 years, where he's an old man now. And someone disrespects him. And he explains to them, you're disrespecting me because I'm old. How many hitmen do you know who get to be old? If someone's old in this business, you know they're good at what they do. Because it's a business that attracts young, impetuous people who want to live fast, die young, and leave a good-looking corpse. So she's surrounded by people who, yeah, they have ambition, but they're not necessarily smart, nor are they particularly patient. And she's constantly having to fight to retain power, but she's got her own shit. She's got two kids, one of whom she adopted from a friend who died a long time ago, and she has been raised to become like the consigliere, to use the mafioso term, you know, the lawyer who is responsible for getting things done and keeping it as legal on the surface as possible. And she's also got a fuck up. She's got a son, it's her own son, it's her biological son. And he's just not good at anything, is he? He's good at lounging around smoking weed and having sex.
He's Sonny.
Yeah, he's
Sonny. He's Sonny Corleone from The Godfather.
Yeah, it's easy.
The daughter is a lot like Michael, in fact. She
It's like a combination between Michael Corleone and Robert Duvall's character. His name is you can find them both. Yeah.
The character is named Kemi. She's played by Adesua Itomi.
Who I think is Adesuma Itomi Wellington now. I don't know. But and that's sort of the framework. It's so easy to look at any crime story, like any sort of organized crime story, through the lens of The Godfather. And that's because The Godfather, it didn't invent the genre, but it codified it.
Yeah.
Very much.
Most mob movies that came after The Godfather are reflecting on it in some way. The Godfather, it's like Dracula. You know, we still can't look past Bela Lugosi. Set the standard. And that's the same with Brando and The Godfather and all of the beats they're in and the things that happen in organized crime.
And I think it's fair to say that even though like Scorsese was making organized crime films at the same time as The Godfather, I think even stuff like Goodfellas and Casino, he saw The Godfather. He knows it's a good movie. You know, you're either consciously doing it or you're consciously undoing it. And structurally, King of Boys has a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
However, there's a lot of it that's very specific, and I think that's the part that's really exciting about this.
What I like, the Godfather is about sort of passing on the legacy. It's an intergenerational story. It's a very Shakespearean story about sort of the fall of Michael, how he, you know, doesn't want to have anything to do with his life of crime, but caring for his father proves to be kind of his downfall.
It's kind of a Henry the Fourth, Henry the Fifth kind of thing.
Yeah. And it's also very masculine. It's very macho. A lot of people look to those characters as sort of like male ideals, which I think is completely effed up.
Toxic
masculinity
weird.
Is so bonkers.
Yeah.
But
look what happens to them in those movies. It's not happy.
Those aren't heroes, guys.
They don't end well. Like, it's not supposed to be a good thing.
You either die in The Godfather 1 or you live long enough to be in Godfather 3.
Either one's a tragedy.
Yeah. what I appreciate about King of Boys is that it stays with the lead character. It stays with Eniola throughout the way she is tries to deal with her fuck-up son, the way she tries to deal with being betrayed, how she goes to prison and what she needs to do to escape. It's her story through and through. And we get to see her at the head of head of a table.
Yeah.
It's like in Thunderball, where she's sitting at this long table and there's these supervillains on either side and she murders one of them to make a point.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's like a proper supervillain, but you really like her. And I think that's a really great thing about the character. And we get to see her rise through flashback, fall, but also survive. It's not about her death or her betrayal.
Yeah.
It's about her survival.
It's actually not, in some respects, it's not the same kind of moral story that we get in a movie like The Godfather, where it's all about, it's so sad. Everyone died or everyone got corrupted. It's hard not to view this film, I think, through a feminist lens, and I think that's actually the most exciting thing about it in some ways, is that it takes this genre, which is very macho oriented. Yeah. I mean, look at Scarface. Scarface is say hello to my giant penis. Like, that's the line translated. That's what he's getting at.
Also, you know, it's De Palma. It's really over the top. It's supposed to be kind of satirical. He's not a hero.
Yeah.
The way he was vaunted as this sort of like masculine hero is totally baffling to me.
I don't think it's baffling in that one, though, because that's a movie about the allure of excess. Mm. What's the line in that movie? First you get the power. First you get the money, then you get the power, then you get the women.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. It is about the acquisition of things that they want, and they even objectify women to that degree.
Yeah.
So that is a movie about the allure of living in excess, and I think that's kind of the trap that these movies sometimes fall into. It's a movie, it's a critique people have lobbed even something like The Wolf of Wall Street, where if we make, we want to understand the appeal of doing these horrible things, but where is the line between showing that it's appealing to, showing why it's appealing to making it look too appealing.
Yeah.
That's an ethical concern with the way that we do our art.
Mm. A lot of filmmakers make the assumption that we're kind of on their moral side.
Yeah.
Like we see that it's fun, but we understand that it's bad, and we're going to see this movie because it appeals to something dark inside of us. And if they let the villains get away with it, I think a lot of filmmakers are understanding that they're catering to a fantasy. They're not actually condoning this. The problem is that looks the same as condoning it.
I feel like that's what the rating system should be more about. It's not about what naughty words you use. It's not about how many people get killed. It's about, do we expect a young audience member to understand the nuance of this?
Sophisticated enough to understand the lessons of this.
Yeah, because it's clearly like you could pick up the wrong lesson from a Scarface. You could pick up the wrong lesson from a Casino or Goodfellas if you're not paying close attention, if you're not really thinking about it.
Not as much King of Boys, though.
No, that's my point. Yeah. That's my point. I actually think there's actually different in that regard. I think those kind of movies they often fail. But they're trying to be these really blunt moral parables. And I don't think that's King of Boys. And I think it's my favorite. I think it's one of my favorite things about it.
Just a little bit morally gray.
It's morally gray. Very, very, very much so by the end of the movie. But it's also not a story in which just everyone fucking dies at the end. It's not about that. It's not about how, it's not this kind of like Catholic morality tale where like Bobby and Susie didn't think they would go to hell for the first time that they had sex. And then of course there was a gas leak in their car and they died. Like there's that very Catholic morality to a lot of Scorsese films in particular, I think.
Because Scorsese himself is Catholic.
Yeah, exactly my point. So with King of Boys, we have a hero who, she has a downfall, but it's not really about that. It's actually about sort of that sort of living hell where she, the bad things that happen to her and the people that she loses, the people that do die around her, she has responsibility for that. And what I love about this is Sola Sabawale gets to give a performance where, unlike, say, that sort of moral ambivalence of Marlon Brando's Godfather, or that, you know, cruel iciness of Michael Corleone. She gets to feel things really, really hard. She actually, like, we get to see her inner turmoil. We get to see her dreams. And when someone close to her dies, I'm not going to ruin who, but when someone close to her dies, she's got like a whole bunch of people around here who are like, it's like that screaming scene in Midsommar. It's just about like, we're just going to feel the grief as much as we possibly can. Mm. It's not about like, and now I'll kill everyone you've ever known. It's like, no, I'm sad. Someone I love died. Yeah. Like, I actually, I'm a human being. And that's something that I think makes this not seem like this kind of like steely coolness. It's actually just like, no, like she does a lot of cool things. She has a lot of fucked up things. She also feels things about all of those.
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting.
And it's interesting that you should bring up the Catholic angle. A lot of the gangster movies do come from this angle of Catholic guilt because they come from a long tradition of Italian Catholics.
Yeah, a lot of mafia movies are specifically about the Italian
Italian Catholic traditions.
Yeah.
I had to look it up while I was watching, like, what the major religions of Nigeria are and what sort of religious and moral traditions they're drawing from. And it's about half and half Muslim and Christian.
Yeah.
And Catholicism is a very small part of those Christians. It's mostly other kinds. And they talk about Christ.
They quote the Bible a few times.
Yeah, the characters are Christians, but they're not drawing from this long-held Catholic tradition that they brought from the old country. They're here. This isn't an immigrant story. This is
yeah.
homegrown. And as such, we're dealing with different moral stances and how a lot of these new people don't draw from any kind of religious tradition. They're not Muslim or Catholic. They're just sort of a-religious. And like they're not expressly atheist. They're just sort of
sometimes they'll go through traditions
yeah.
In order to solidify their standing, but they don't necessarily believe in that. Right. And that's another thing where that is a generational dynamic as well, where we have people who, you know, fought really, really hard for things and have strong, firmly held beliefs on things. And then there are people who believe if I steal enough money and kill enough people, I win.
Yeah.
And that's not the same kind of, I mean, you could say that a character like Enola Salami is evil. I wouldn't fight you too hard.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that she's not complicated or that that's the only side to her, but she's not a good person. She does a lot of really, really, really terrible things, but she has character. Mm. Not that she is a character. She has character. She has principles. She has beliefs. There are things that she will do and won't do. And that sets her apart from someone who is just going to kill anyone and anything that gets in their way just because all they care about is the acquisition of power because they're boys.
They're boys, and they figure out that that's the fast way.
Yeah.
It's the fast way to do it. If we're just tougher and faster and have more guns, then we win.
Yeah.
Which is naive, it's dumb, it's very masculine, and, and I appreciate that. Ultimately, they kind of fail. Now, I don't want to say what happens at the end of the film, but I will say that the ending is really, really good.
Yeah.
It's ultimately the story about how Enola has to... The big story is that people don't find her as credible as she once was because these young upstarts are now causing a lot more trouble. It looks like they might actually have more power than her.
Well, it's
and she's in a position.
Also, the old folks to whom she stole power want it back.
Yeah,
and there's also people,
she's not popular.
And also, there've always been people more powerful than her, and they refuse to let her grow in station. Mm. And the implication is strongly that there's a lot of inherent sexism in that.
Yeah, she has to fight twice as hard just to stay still, and. But through all of this, it's not just about sort of keeping her power. She understands it's power that, you know, is going to keep her, you know, important in this world. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of this has to do with her trying to maintain her dignity as somebody who actually is intelligent and can think through these systems and does have a moral code and who is not respected. And so when she is arrested, it's actually doubly humiliating for her. And there's a scene near the end of the movie where she's in a prison cell and just like having all of these like horrendous flashbacks and essentially arguing with her former self about how she got here and if she made the right decisions. It's a little mawkish and heavy handed.
Yeah.
It works well though, because we get to see how Enola is really struggling in that moment. And when we get down to the ending, at first we see, I don't want to say what happens again, but we see that she is, suffering some pretty horrible indignities, and we see that her dignity has been completely undercut. And then there's this final twist that says no, that she's actually okay. And I appreciate that kind of double back, how it looks like she's hit rock bottom, but really she's back on top. And and I don't want to.
I feel like the story of Enola Salami is a story of she's succeeding within an immoral universe, and that's an immoral universe in which she found herself through no fault of her own at too young an age. Her options were limited, and she took all the opportunities she could, and she made the most of them. And in order to do that, she had to do some really heinous things. People were doing heinous things anyway.
Yeah.
People were doing heinous things to her. So she did what she could, and it's hard not to find within that story, and again, she kills people. She's really not nice. But her dignity comes across. There's a screenwriting trick I was taught in school, and I've never really, I don't think there are a lot of exceptions to it. And what I was told was everyone's so focused on trying to make sure your characters are likable. Likable is easy and often boring. You know, just to like, oh, they like puppies. Cool. Done.
Likeable cool is an offshoot of that.
Yeah, exactly. What the trick that I was taught, and I think it mostly works, is we will like the character, or at least respect the character, even if they're a bad person, if they're good at their job.
Yeah.
You show them that they have a job to do, and they're really, really... This is every movie Michael Mann's ever made, except maybe The Keep. Like, it's just people who are good at their job, even if they're terrible human beings. They're like Heat, those are not nice people, but they're good thieves, and you want to stay with them.
Latter-day Mammoth as well.
Yeah. So... And that's, I think a lot of crime stories, that's what keeps us interested in a lot of people, even though they're not good people. We wouldn't want to know them in reality.
They're good at crime.
Yeah, so we want to see them do their job.
And that can be fun as well. You look at it like a heist movie.
Yeah.
Something like, you know, the Ocean's 11 films. Those guys are really good at heisting casinos.
Yeah. It's a key to a lot of anti-heroes, I think. You look at someone like, I don't know, Jake Gyllenhaal in Nightcrawler. He's a monster in Nightcrawler. He's doing these horrible things to, like, get, like, salacious footage of car wrecks, but he's good at it, and it's fascinating to watch him do it. Breaking Bad's another one of those where he's a monster. He's a terrible human being, especially by the end of that show. But he's so damn good at making meth. Like, he's so good at it. Like, you can't, like, take your eyes off him, because no matter what horrible things he does, it's fascinating to see him succeed, just because we admire talent, don't we? And Enyola is really talented at a lot of the things that she does. But literally the entire world in which she operates is working against her. Like, the only person who isn't actively working against her, either by explicit design or through incompetence, is her daughter.
Yeah.
That's it. She's the only person she can consistently rely on. And that's a tough situation to be in. And so we want to see her persevere, because we know she has it in her, even though she's a kind of a monster. And I think Sola Sobowale gives a really fantastic performance, showing all of that strength, but also the vulnerability that comes with that. Like, when you're that attacked for so long, that scene you talked about, this, like, dream sequence where her younger version of herself, who rose to power and, like, broke people's necks at a table full of people, just like, that's my seat. That person looks at who she is now and doesn't recognize her. Like, what I would never have let what happened to you happen to me, is basically the line. And she's been through more than that. She's raised two kids. She's been suffering these slings and arrows basically alone, with no one to rely on, for decades. It wears you down. It's hard to do. Even like a job that isn't that difficult, if you're doing it all by yourself for decades, it just wears you down. She's not a lot left of her. And so we're seeing this situation that expands, involving murder and bribery and corrupt police officers and theft of money hidden in septic tanks, which is really gross. All of these things are conspiring just to destroy her.
Yeah.
And the question is, will she let it? And that's the part of the movie that feels really heroic and awesome. I mostly like this movie. I really do. I don't know if it needed to be 3 hours. I feel like it's a little padded sometimes.
They included a lot of details. There's, like, long musical numbers. There's a lot of musicians in the movie. As a Nigerian national epic, though, I think it really touched on something. And I think it did stretch across. There's, like, dozens of characters, and if you're paying attention, there's the guy who's being blackmailed by this sex worker, and, you know, who's living in this, has something to do with an accountant who's connected to this, and, like, all of the way the crime machinations come down. A little complicated. You have to pay close attention. There's little tiny plot points. They're constantly being thrown at you.
You can't play Homescapes on your phone while watching this. You
no, and it's also bilingual. It's partially in English, and it's partially in Yoruba, and I think
A couple other Nigerian languages.
So you have to pay attention, and they're constantly skipping throughout, like, even in single lines of dialogue. It's like a Bollywood film in that regard. So they're clearly trying to cover a lot of ground.
Yeah.
And if you're going to cover a lot of ground, I think you do need a big, long running time.
That's fair. Yeah. That's fair.
It's like, don't leave anything out. Let's just include it all. And in that, I respect that they just did include it all. It wasn't necessary for, like, plot or character development. Not necessarily.
I feel like the pacing could have been tweaked a little bit. I think you could have lost 20 minutes.
What I like about it is that it kind of rises and falls a couple times throughout. Mm-hmm. We're used to movies moving in a certain way. It climaxes in one gigantic thing. And I think this has a few little miniature climaxes that kind of build on each other after a while. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could cut out one of those stories, but I appreciate that they're in there.
Well, and one thing I will say is that running time gives us such a richness to that world, as you described, mm-hmm. that it makes me want to see more of it, mm-hmm. honestly. And like, this is one of those shows where I'm like, this was one of those movies where I'm like, this is a good movie. I like this movie a lot. Performances are mostly really, really good. It's mm-hmm. a good, interesting world in which we live. Familiar if you've seen The Godfather, but so is every mafia movie, so I'm not going to complain too hard about that. But I feel like the ultimate thing I can say at the end of it is I would watch a TV show that takes place after this.
Oh, gosh. You know, if this becomes popular enough as a film on Netflix, there's no way they wouldn't develop this into a series.
I want to see, like, just, I want to see her, like, fighting her way back up the ladder.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know, maybe you do the Godfather Part 2 thing and make it more about, like, you know, a couple of years ago, more stuff that she did. Yeah, about like the earlier
young,
on.
Young version of the character.
Yeah.
Or start it where it leaves off.
Exactly.
And have it be about where the final setting of the film is.
Yeah, that sounds really fucking awesome to me. I'm trying to think. It's frustrating sometimes when you watch a good movie. Now, this isn't like the best movie I've ever seen or anything, but like, mm-hmm. it's good enough that it's hard to single things out for like extended conversation without going, that part was neat.
Right.
I like that part. This character was good. Good writing. Like, I don't know. Writing praise as a critic is so difficult.
Like, there's only, like, you got a stock little pile of adjectives right by your computer, and you run out pretty quick after a while.
There's only so many good, there's so many bad things to compare things to, that when you have to compare things to good things all the time, when you have to use positive adjectives, you realize there are fewer positive adjectives than negatives, or at least more complicated ones after a while. And the other problem that I run into as a critic, if there's a movie I just plain like, I don't have a particular problem with it, I don't see even anything particularly like controversial that needs to be explored, I just think it's good, damn it. Mm. If I spend too much time praising it, I worry that I sound untrustworthy.
Like you're overselling it.
I sound like a hype man or something like that, or like a barker, like, come on in and see the fantastic new.
right.
You know, and like, yeah, That's not my job. Yeah.
This is why so many critics like say things like, "Oh, I prefer to see a bad movie than a boring one."
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course you do, because it's easy to write about a bad movie.
Mm-hmm.
You have things to say about it. You have all these adjectives you can dip into.
Well,
a boring one is, you know, less interesting to write about. You have fewer things to say about it.
Well, for me, a boring one is just it evokes no emotions in me, and I'm just sort of sitting there stone-faced. The bad one, at least I'm feeling something.
But I'd rather be stone-faced and bored than, you know, feeling active hate towards something.
No.
That's not a pleasant feeling.
No, not... Wait a minute. Hate might be a bit extreme, but, like, you know, just sort of just, like, having something to think about versus not having something to think about.
I'd rather watch, like, Death at a Funeral, just sort of a middling comedy, than, like, Human Centipede 3.
Okay, well, again,
which is just revolting.
Again, hate might be something I'm not necessarily looking forward to. And again, there's something to be said for movies that lull you or that have a languid pace and make you and are sort of leisurely and maybe even what some people would call conventionally boring. There's a place for that. There's certainly that's a certain kind of art form that can certainly be appreciated if you sort of get out of this weird headspace where you need to be constantly not just entertained but like distracted constantly. Like, it's not a movie's job to like keep your attention every single second. Like, you know, it's pacing and quiet moments and moments of reflection.
Mm-hmm.
These are all useful things. But I think there's a difference between that and just not telling a compelling enough story to make me give a shit.
Okay.
So
where does King of Boys fall into this?
There's a couple of moments here where I feel as though the movie is a little too familiar or spinning its wheels a little bit.
Yeah.
But no, when all is said and done,
I agree.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that, like, and those are the parts that I feel like we didn't really need that bit, that, or it could have been shortened, and I would have gotten the gist of it, and we could have moved on to the stuff that really works, because the stuff that really works is everything with Sola Sobowale. She gives a really, really great lead performance. It's unlike any, like, mafioso performance I think I've seen. And yet she's just as threatening and just as intimidating as any mafioso. Like, I would love to see her as a Batman villain. Like, that kind of, like, larger than life sort of. I feel like it's frustrating because this is such a good performance, and it's in a movie that a lot of people won't see because they are not excited by international cinema. And that stinks, and it sucks that there's, like, I hope people notice. This is one of those, again, this movie's a couple years old now. Hopefully the moment hasn't passed entirely, but oftentimes Hollywood looks to international film to say, like, oh, that's an interesting actor. Let's make them the bad guy in the next Mission Impossible. Like, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But that often introduces those actors to the world. Look at Mads Mikkelsen, for example. Like, he started off making some interesting international films, and then they made him the bad guy in Casino Royale, and he started getting bigger American roles, and now he's very well known here.
I already knew Mads Mikkelsen was, but that's because
you follow international movies. You follow other films. We didn't know him from his American stuff yet.
No, I'm trying to think, when did I first see Mads Mikkelsen?
Yeah. I don't know what you first saw him in.
Did you see Another Round?
No, I hear it's good, though.
It's very good.
Yeah, I haven't gotten around to it yet.
I think it was like The Green Butchers. Yeah, I forgot. I don't remember what I saw.
Oh, was he in Pusher? Was that him?
Oh, maybe so.
Was he in Pusher? Anyway, I digress. So, like, yeah, give her big roles, please. She's really, really talented. And this filmmaker, Kemi Adetiba. I hope I'm pronouncing that.
Yeah, this is only her second film.
Yeah, and her first film was like the biggest film in like Nollywood history, and the sequel to that film, which she didn't direct, but like the sequel to that film is now like the biggest. So like she's made some hit films over there. I'm like, this is the kind of person who, like, hey, bring them over here and let them direct a James Bond movie. Like, that's what they do. They find interesting people all over the world, and they're like, okay, cool, let's give them something mainstream. And I'm like, actually, I'd like to see her do that. I think she's got a distinct flavor of this shows her, like, hey, let's do a Godfather movie, but can you make it distinct?
That's also a very American attitude, though. Let her come over here and do movies on our country.
You're right. It's a little selfish, isn't it?
How about she just continue to make hits in Nigeria and make important Nigerian films and then bring them here where we get into them here?
And that is absolutely what should be done. And I totally agree with that. My only concern is, and it's a cynical concern, some people won't watch non-American movies. So,
well,
that's
why we're here, is to sell people on Nigerian cinema.
It's not my place to give career advice. I actually like to thank you for that. That's some bullshit I just said. So, but my point is that I want her to be super successful and get to do whatever she wants to do.
And there's a lot of money in those big franchise pictures. I understand that. But it is frustrating to me that so many of these big franchise pictures do tend to find indie directors or first or second time directors who have made a few like really notable, interesting hits with interesting ideas and push them into this big moneyed world right away where their voice is kind of drowned out by the company line. And so while it's good for their careers and good for their pocketbooks, it doesn't seem to be the best for them exploring like their own aesthetics and their own art.
I
wish there were a way where they could get that money and then do whatever they wanted.
Yeah,
here we're gonna hire you on. Like, I'm really ambivalent about Chloe Zhao doing a Marvel film.
Yeah,
because
she's already done it. It's in the can.
It's in the can. She made one, and I'm like, well, how much of that is gonna be Chloe Zhao, and how much of that is gonna be just the house aesthetic?
Yeah, because Marvel's pretty like there's a couple of filmmakers whose personality I think shown through to Taika Waititi.
Taika Waititi movie. Shane Black, I think, is like. Because Shane Black could work sort of in that kind of movie.
He kind of invented that kind of
Iron
movie,
yeah, Iron Man 3 is very much a Shane Black film.
Yeah, but oftentimes people just get lost in that sort of Marvel tone, and that's what they're there for. Well,
Kenneth Branagh made one. Anybody could have made that Kenneth Branagh movie. That's not a Kenneth Branagh film.
No, I'm glad his career wasn't, like, he hadn't made a hit movie in a while, so I think that kind of helped him out a little bit. But, that's a totally fair point. However, sometimes, it's interesting, there's always that thing like, well, like, you know, after they do their Marvel movie, they can do some, like, cool smaller stuff. And I'm like, occasionally they do. Like, Taika Waititi went from Thor Ragnarok to Jojo Rabbit. Won him an Academy Award. I love that movie. I think it was a really good movie. And that's a really daring movie. Yeah, that's a movie that not everybody would have greenlit.
It would have been great if Taika Waititi could have just made Jojo Rabbit. It's like one for me, one for you sort of thing.
Yeah. I think he was working on it beforehand. I remember I interviewed him for... did I interview him for? I interviewed him for Hunt for the Wilder People.
Okay.
Which is a great movie, by the way. See that movie. That movie's great. And he was talking about this movie he was working on, and it was just sort of a log line at the time. But anyway, he had to make Thor first, because that was what was next for him. So I don't know. Maybe it had nothing to do with it. Maybe it didn't. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure if Kemi Adetiba wants to come to the United States.
Yeah, and it's make not big my place American to say. I regret viewing her career, or the career of anyone, really, through this very limited lens of expectation. You do a small movie, then you do a big movie for a studio, and then you have more freedom. That's only one tiny way to do it.
But I understand your thinking, because that's the way it's been operating for so long. These notable indie and even international directors are being sort of swept up in this big machine. And like I said, that's a good way to advance their careers. Rian Johnson made a Star Wars film. I like that Star Wars film.
I think it's a great Star Wars film.
It is a legit good movie. There's some weird ambivalence about it, sort of in the fan community, for whatever that's worth.
I don't think it's ambivalence. I think it's just half and half. So we'll love it.
But he chased that with a movie called Knives Out, which is this. I think it was Matt Zoller Seitz who says people don't like that movie. That's like not liking pastry. It's a confection of a movie. It's wonderful.
It's not my favorite. Mm. I think it kind of whiffs some of a social commentary and. No, your mileage is going to dramatically vary on this, but I was a little ahead of the movie, I think.
It's a whodunit,
and I like to be surprised, and I was I kind of guessed who did it too early, and it just kind of wasn't as fun for me as a result.
When it comes to some whodunits, I don't mind. Going back to Kenneth Branagh, he remade Murder on the Orient Express. I knew whodunit going in.
It's a good point.
And it's still a thrill watching it unfold.
And I'm not making that. That's not too bad. But it's a fun movie. I like that movie. And he just, apparently, I don't know how true this is, but I heard he retained the sequel rights, and then he just sold the sequels, like two sequels, to Netflix for $450 million. Good for you, dude.
So yeah.
Seriously, you made like an Agatha Christie mystery, like when people were not making that shit. And you did it your way, and it's totally you. There's no one can claim that's not a Rian Johnson movie. And you just turned that into a giant fucking moneymaker for you.
What I would love to see is Kemi Adetiba. Okay, she makes the Star Wars film. I don't want to see the Star Wars film she makes.
We can skip that.
I want to see if that Star Wars film is successful, as they tend to be, what she does after that.
Right.
If she gets swept up in the Hollywood machine, or if she goes back to Nigeria with all this extra lucre and makes an even bigger film than King of Boys.
Yeah.
King of Boys Part 2, and it's like four hours long. It is an even more intricate story.
There was a thing on Netflix when I looked up King of Boys to watch it, and it was like a sometimes they'll have like an image for like an upcoming thing on Netflix, and it was also called King of Boys, and it was like something else. And I don't know if that's just another movie with the same title, or if there's like a sequel coming. I hope there's a sequel coming, because I want to see that shit. Let's see that shit. I want to see that shit. So I want to say a big thanks to David Cooper for recommending this film, asking us to review it for you here on Your Critically Acclaimed. And I want to give a big shout out to him, especially for supporting the show. And that means a lot to us. And to those of you who have Your Critically Acclaimed, they're in the queue. We're working on another one later this week. They're coming. We're working on them, and we love these, because so many people think that like what the audience for like film criticism is interested in is the same shit. Everyone's like, hey, people only like it when we like review Batman movies or whatever. And I'm like, actually, people have really interesting tastes and ideas, and they like to explore stuff often that like doesn't get that much attention, or they want us to like... It's so wonderful to see what people get super excited about, because sometimes it's mainstream. That's cool too. I like a lot of mainstream stuff, but oftentimes we find films like this. And this is a movie that someone was really passionate about and wanted to share with people and wanted to boost the signal. I'm glad we could.
So here we are doing that. And I'm glad we can, because I like it.
Yeah, it's neat.
I'd hate to watch this movie and hate it and talk about you need to avoid this film you've never heard of.
That would have sucked. But but we would have had to do it. We would have had to do it. That would have been the job. So thank you everybody for listening. Again, King of Boys is currently available on Netflix. Pretty easy to find. It might vary from country to country. I know we have some international listeners, but in America anyway, it's currently on Netflix. Mm-hmm. You can head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork and enjoy a whole bunch of that's the opposite of the point. You can get a whole bunch of exclusive shows that come with any tier, including shows about Batman, Star Trek, Disney, commentary tracks, the Academy Awards, ton of stuff there. And yeah, one of the tiers, you can ask us to do a custom podcast for you. And this is one of them. So thank you once again. You can always email us. letters@criticallyacclaimed.net is the email address. We're on Twitter. That's right. We're on Twitter. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
Together we are at Critic Acclaim. And until next time, you're critically acclaimed. Yes, you.